Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer. Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Bors. So we talked a lot about the Labour leadership campaign this week, but what about that dreaded B word, Brexit? What's going on then? I mean, the Trade Commissioner for the EU, Phil Hogan, this week said that it was impossible to get a full free trade agreement by the end of the year. James, what do you reckon?
I don't think it's a dreaded B word, Cindy. But
for number 10 these days.
But on this trade deal, I think this is kind of interesting tension between the UK and the EU. The kind of UK view is, well, hang on a second, you signed up to this political declaration that says you're going to work towards doing this by December 2020, and now you're saying there's not enough time. I think the EU thought that when Boris Johnson said he wouldn't extend, that this was more electioneering for an actual policy position. So I mean, they're quite surprised by how robust the government is on this point. I mean, the big argument is going to be over what the EU calls this no-dumping stuff, no-dumping line, which essentially is code for they want the UK to carry on following UK social and environmental rules after Brexit. Now, there is some EU countries, I think, would be happy with simply the UK agreeing not to go backwards from where they are now. Other countries, notably the French, would like kind of the UK to kind of follow the EU where the EU goes. So, you know, if the EU tightens up its environmental rules, the UK would then have to do the same. The government is hugely resistant to both of those, particularly the idea of carrying on following EU rules. But the problem with the non-regression idea is who polices that? I think anything that involved a European court having a say on whether the UK was going backwards or not would be very difficult. I think the UK government's line would be, we've legislated for net zero, we're increasing our minimum wage at the fastest rate of any advanced country, you know, we are not cutting standards, so you don't need to worry about that. But I think this is going to be, you know, the first round of the talks, I think, is going to be over this level playing field question.
And Katie, there's a feeling on the British side that, you know, in the next stage of the trade negotiations may be slightly easier than the previous one, just because the EU27 will have different goals from these trade negotiations, and then we can divide and conquer. Do you think that's a valid perspective?
Well, when you say that, we do get a sense of déjà vu in the sense that clearly, and I think in perhaps even in some pieces in The Spectator, there is this argument that actually the EU wouldn't stay united. And I think it was a surprise to many, and politicians openly admit this, that the EU were a more united bloc, I think, than many anticipated going into it. But part of the reason the EU seemed so united was because on the UK side, it was just absolute chaos at points. It wasn't even, you know, Labour and the Tories had different views on where Brexit should be going. The Conservative Party itself was fighting each other. And
the cabinet itself.
Exactly. So I think that added to this level that the EU were a united bloc and the UK couldn't, you know, the UK could barely even get its own position together. I think that when it comes to financial interests, look, we already know there are certain states which are less idealistic in terms of what the EU as an organisation should be doing and are expected to be more pragmatic. But something that Dominic Cummings in number 10 has said to many of his colleagues is, don't count on Angela Merkel to get the UK out because you think Germany is more pragmatic. So I think that there is a sense that there'll be different interests and people want to protect those. But I also don't even get the sense from those on the UK side that they think that is what is going to get them a good deal. I do think one of the things the UK think they can do is the idea that they can walk away, so the threat of walking away. It's interesting because in the Brussels Trade Commissioner interview that we've been talking about, he accused Boris Johnson of brinkmanship with the strategy, the idea that you were just going to ultimately use as your main negotiating tool the fact that you now have a majority of 80, and if you want to leave without a new trade deal, you can. And that clearly does rattle the EU. I mean, does it get results? We don't know yet. I mean, I think one of the fights to look out for is looking at those comments is the idea that something the Trade Commissioner did bring up was whether the UK could give the EU fishing rights in return for financial services help. Now, fishing is a hugely political potent issue in the UK, and it's something that number 10 don't want to budge on, and particularly like so early on, I think it would set a very difficult tone. I think politically, if you give up on fishing rights at the start of these negotiations, it's going to be very unpopular in Scotland, also in various coastal communities in the rest of the UK. And I think it is also an issue Nigel Farage has campaigned so heavily on, which is, you know, fishermen getting back, you know, their waters, of getting back their rights, that I just think that were you to move there, I just think it sets this whole backdrop to the negotiations would be against everything Number 10 is trying to say.
James, so tell us what to look out for in the coming weeks in terms of the trade negotiations. Obviously, they haven't started yet, so when can we expect them to start and what will be top of the agenda?
I think we expect them to kind of formally start in March, but I think it's fair to say the two sides are kind of circling each other right now, kind of trying to find out their positions. I think Katie is right on the fishing point, will be very early on, because if you look at what the EU is saying, the EU essentially is seeking a continuation of pretty much things as we are now in terms of the rights of EU vessels to fish in UK waters and the same kind of quotas. I think that would be very, very politically a very hard sell. I think Katie also hit the nail on the head about the Scottish question here, which is, you know, if you end up with fishing going for financial services straight away, Nicola Sturgeon was like, the one bit of Brexit that might have benefited Scotland, fish, you know, we've been sold out, you know, before the talks have even really got going. And that would be tricky. But I think the most important thing to get our heads around here is that this UK government accepts that there is going to be friction at the border. Now, that is what happens when you leave a single market and the customs union. Once you've accepted that friction at the border, that is the biggest decision. And then the degree of the friction that goes from a kind of WTO arrangements to a Canada Plus deal is not actually that great and is nowhere near as big as the difference between friction and no friction. So in a way, one of the things that happens is that once you've accepted that there is going to be friction, as this government does, you are in a less vulnerable negotiating position, because the difference between walking away and ending up trading on World Trade Organization terms and signing a Canada-style deal is not that big.
And Katie, today we have a couple of the Labour leadership contenders launching their campaigns formally. Recolon Bailey will be in Manchester and Emily Thornberry will be in the rather northern area of Guildford, which for listeners who don't know is in Surrey.
Yes, so I think if we want to, I don't think we even need to scratch the surface too deep to get some messages from where these are based. I mean, in terms of where these launches are happening, I think that clearly there is a push going on amongst various candidates, Rebecca Long Bailey we can put in this, to say that they are going to reunite the party with seats they have lost, and to say that, you know, if you look at the so-called red wall, whether or not you class that specific area, that actually as these areas are critical and you can't just be almost a party for Islington. Now, Emily Thornberry isn't suggesting she's going to be a party for Islington. She's moved all the way out to Surrey. But it does play into this, I think, this stereotype of Emily Thornberry, which I think Keir Starmer can also find himself wrapped up in, which is the idea that they are, you know, Islington liberals who are out of touch with the rest of the country. And I think if either of them were to be Labour leaders, you'd hear the Tories try and plant that message a lot of the time. I think that there's an interesting question here, which is ultimately the Labour membership is very pro-EU. So is it helpful for someone like Emily Thornberry or Keir Starmer to show to be that they are leaning towards Remain? I think some of these area choices, if you look at kind of where people are focusing, you could read them into that. Or is it the case that when the membership are going to be picking their leader, they are looking at how to win and, you know, they want to move past Brexit? I think the comments so far from Keir Starmer and Emily Thornberry suggest that they do want to put the Brexit issue to bed, or at least for now they don't want to talk about it too much, because they feel that the way the result went means that Keir Starmer, particularly in his role in evolving Labour's Brexit position to a second referendum, isn't perhaps the most flattering light. So he says he doesn't want it to be a second referendum. But I think Emily Thornberry choosing to go where she has will just kind of reiterate this view of her already, which is that she is more focused, I think, on Remain. It can be accused of being London focused. But there is an argument here, which is, where do Labour pick up their votes? One argument I don't think we've had any candidate make yet, but others have, is if politics is realigning, and you have seen that with the Conservative Party and the fact that it has won lots of these seats that hadn't turned blue before, is there an argument that the way for Labour to now realign itself, if you look at where population is rising, how they won Putney, how they are doing well in, you know, certain areas, should they be going for Lib Dem voters and Greens and Labour and heavy that way? And in a way, accepting that they are going to, you know, struggle to win some seats back, you know, like Bishop Auckland, and focusing their energy elsewhere. I don't think anyone wants to make that argument right now who's in the race. There are some who say, well, they tried that before and it didn't work. But one of the problems with the election position was they weren't completely pro-EU. I mean, they turned off a lot of Leave voters to the second referendum policy, but there were also a lot of pro-second referendum people who didn't think they were embracing the EU enough, so it's almost a halfway house. So should they just go all the other way? Now, it'd be interesting if somebody like Emily Thornberry started to advance the argument, but for now, I think they just want to not talk about Brexit, perhaps a little bit like Number 10.
But if you look across the English-speaking Western world, you are seeing this realignment where centre-right parties are doing better in traditionally working-class areas that normally voted for the centre-left party, and the centre-left progressive party is doing better in kind of upscale areas with lots of graduates that used to vote consistently for the centre-right party. Now, as Katie said, no political party ever wants to be told that getting back into office is a two-term programme. You know, even in 1997, after Tories had lost by 179 seats, no one stood up and said, oh, it's going to take us 8 years. People don't want to hear that. But there is an argument that if you consider that Labour is not going to go back to the days of consistently returning 30-odd, 40-odd MPs in Scotland, where can the majority come from? You would have to take seats that are currently Tory Lib Dem marginal, such as Guildford, which is changing because, you know, as young people move out of London, you know, commute in, the nature of these places, and you know, the home counties are becoming less Tory because of the demographic changes. And so, you know, you could see an argument for how that this is the progress in time, but I don't think the Labour Party is ready to hear this. I think one thing I will say about Emily Thornberry, who, you know, isn't going to win and just scraped on, she's going to be she's going to be the most quotable person. Who at the dispatch box is the best performer of the Labour contenders? You know, it's Emily Thornberry. Now, Jess Phillips is a good speaker, but she's never spoken from the dispatch box. She always speaks from that. But in the back benches. But Thornberry is quotable and waspish, and I think she will add that element to these hustings.
James, given that she's got these qualities of eloquence and statesmanship...
I wouldn't call it statesmanship necessarily. I think she's quotable, which is a different...
Why has she flopped so badly in this campaign so far? I mean, so Labour List Survation poll puts her at 1%. She's got the name recognition. She's Shadow Foreign Secretary. She's got experience. She's on the right side of history in terms of Brexit, according to Labour supporters. So what's going on?
Because I think she had, when Caroline Flint made that accusation, which Emily Thornberry heavily denies, that Emily Thornberry had made disparaging comments about Labour Leave voters. I think that basically caused massive problems for her campaign. Mm-hmm. And then the other question for her is, like, what does she have that Keir Starmer doesn't?
She's a woman.
But then so many other, if that is your primary concern, there are three other women in the Labour leadership race.
Yeah, I mean, like, she does rub up parliamentary colleagues the wrong way. I think that's quite clear from the fact that she did have a real slog to get the number of MPs she needed to meet the threshold to get through the next round. And also, I mean, we don't have to go too far back in political history to remember when Emily Thornberry under
Rochester, yeah.
Ed Miliband in Rochester, you know, did that infamous tweet about a flag. So she's not a flawless politician, perhaps to put it mildly. She does have name recognition, but I think she is divisive. And I think one of her issues is that it would be surprising if Lisa Nandy wins the Labour leadership contest. It would be a big surprise. At the moment, it looks like it is between Keir Starmer and Rebecca Long-Bailey. But because less is known about Lisa Nandy, she has potential to move in the competition. I think one of Emily Thornberry's problems is people feel like they do know her. Mm. So actually, to land certain points, it's a more uphill struggle to change someone's opinion of you rather than in the first place to introduce yourself.
James and Katie, thanks very much. And I'm just going to plug one more time this event we have coming up, asking whether or not it's time to give amnesty to Britain's illegal immigrants. Fraser Nelson thinks so, and so does Kate Andrews, our newly joined economics correspondent. But against them will be David Goodhart. So they will be arguing it out on the 25th of February in the Emmanuel Centre. And to get tickets, go to spectator.co.uk/amnesty podcast. Thanks for listening, and join us again tomorrow, where Katie Balls will be talking to Tom Tuchinhardt, MP, about whether or not Huawei is a risk.